Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. You're never too young to care about climate change. Younger Americans are more likely to engage with the issue. That's according to data from Pew Research Center. And we're not just talking about millennials and Gen Zers, but also kids in elementary and middle school. This hour, we're going to hear from the authors of three children's books all about climate change and taking action. There's some scientific research showing that climate action can help young people cope with climate change and even make them more hopeful. Joining me now is UConn sociologist Dr. Phoebe Godfrey, who's the author of A North Pole Tale, written to help children and parents learn and talk about climate change. Thank you so much, Phoebe, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And we also have with us environmental scientist Lena Champlin. Lena, good to have you on Where We Live today.
Thanks so much.
And we also have with us Jeremy Wurzel, who's in the middle of his residency of psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Thank you, Jeremy, for being with us.
Oh, I'm so excited for this conversation. Thanks for having us.
When Lena and Jeremy are co-authors of Coco's Fire, Changing Climate Anxiety into Climate Action, written for children between 6 and 10 years old. And listeners, you can also join the conversation. Let us know if you have any questions, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So, Lena, I want to start with you to talk about Coco's Fire. Can you tell us, when did the idea start? How did it spark for both of you?
Absolutely. So when I was in graduate school in environmental science, my lab was located at the Academy of Natural Sciences, which is a natural history museum in Philadelphia. And I really enjoyed doing a lot of outreach with kids and families at that natural history museum. I think our conversations really started to think about how do we talk about climate change when I was doing this outreach event and a little girl came up to my table and I asked her, do you know what climate change is? And her caregiver kind of pulled her aside and was like, oh, no, we don't talk about climate change. So it made me kind of wonder if I had done something wrong, if bringing up climate change was a bad thing to certain age groups. And so that led me to talk to Jeremy, who is my partner and studies psychiatry. And so I kind of like asked him if there are certain ages that we should talk to people about climate change and what the best mechanisms are for doing that. So that kind of started those conversations.
That's so interesting because as we were talking about preparing for this show, I was also thinking to myself, I can't quite pinpoint exactly when climate change became a thing for me, but I want to say like middle school, like a little bit before middle school, maybe like late elementary school. For me, but certainly at that time, it hadn't been labeled climate change yet. So it's been really kind of fascinating kind of going back and then thinking ahead on how that sort of education has been for me. But Jeremy, sounds like there was a big research portion that included psychology that Lena mentioned. I'm super interested in that. Can you walk us through what that process was like, figuring out what ages you can start teaching children climate change?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just to kind of bounce off Lena's story, when we started having these conversations, it reminded me of all of the hard topics that we do have with young people about death, divorce, the birds and the bees, and the number of resources that we have from a psychoeducational perspective to guide families in those conversations, and the lack of resources there are for conversations around climate. And so we were then like, gosh, well, maybe there are resources out there. How can we explore this? And so we conducted a bit of a literature review, trying to understand what resources were out there for families, when to start having these climate talks, and how to best have these climate talks. Regarding the age specifically, there's some evidence that there's this gap between when young people start actually learning about climate change in school, as you mentioned, Catherine, that this happens like in late elementary school and early middle school, when environmental science classes are starting to be discussing this topic. And so that's when young people start to gain kind of a larger appreciation for the science of it. However, there's an age between around 3 and 9 that young people have the kind of developmental capacity to start engaging with much harder topics, and actually from a healthcare perspective, start to engage with their own healthcare decisions and difficult decisions regarding their own health. And so we realized there was this huge gap when young people start to have the capacity to address some larger issues and when they were actually getting the information. And so that's actually how we kind of honed in on our specific age group of kind of early elementary school, when young people might start hearing about this conversation, about hearing about climate change through a number of resources, but not actually having the information at their fingertips.
And I think that is super interesting, because it's just one of those details that you don't really think about, that 3 to 9, I think you said 3 to 9 is a good time to do that, or a good time for that information to be soaked in, I think. And there's also this comparison too. Lena, I want to toss this to you. The idea of a tough medical diagnosis, it's something that's more towards an individual person, versus when we're talking about climate change, it's more of a collective kind of diagnosis. You know, can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think that, like, when we experience learning about climate change, we engage with it on a personal level and on a collective level. So I think that there's a lot of feelings of fear and stress for an individual and your experience of it, and then also for others and future generations and everything, which is probably even more weighty than even just your own safety.
Right.
And I think that, yeah, I think that as people engage with it, I think that there tends to be a lot of environmental education that surrounds individual responses. So putting a lot of onus on an individual, like a lot of the actions that are suggested are like, you should recycle more, you should do this, you should do that. And so I think even in our messaging in environmental science around responding, it's very individualistic. And so we promote the idea that responses should also be collective, and there should be more sort of community engagement as a response to climate change.
Well, I love that you mentioned recycling, because that's actually the first thing that popped into my mind when I was learning about climate change, I think, before it was labeled climate change. And Phoebe, want to talk to you too. You know, you have your book, A North Pole Tale. How did you consider transparency for your younger readers around this very hard topic? And also just a very quick spoiler alert for our listeners who have kids who are listening. You know, we will be talking about a very specific North Pole resident in particular. So if you don't want to get that spoiler, you might want to catch us later, or just put us on pause for a brief 30 seconds. But Phoebe, you know, what inspired your book?
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. It just came to me. It was little bit after Christmas back in 2015, my wife and I were out snowshoeing, and it just like this, it was like a download, and the whole story almost came into my mind. And I was like, oh my goodness, who better to help children understand this than Santa Claus? And, you know, when we think of ourselves as a consumer society and you know, the melding of different stories, for me, you know, Christmas is story. There's story there. And, you know, and there are different stories that have been woven together, right? There's a pagan story. There's a Christian story. There's a traditional story of this ancient, you know, Saint Nicholas, who, you know, originated in what is now Turkey, you know, woven with Germanic aspects, Father Christmas, the Green Man, and all these fabulous sort of mythological tales, a kind of the collective unconscious of this wonderful being who cares for children. In fact, St. Nicholas was the patron saint of toy makers, right? And kind of reminding ourselves where these threads came from. And at the time, in my own life, I had learned that I have a half-brother who's Jewish and lives in Israel. And so that inspired this idea that if Santa Claus lives in the North Pole tail and the North, right, and the tail part is mine, but he must have relatives, like he must have family who are Inuit, who are the indigenous people. And so the idea of combining aspects of our story, our from the sort of the West of Santa and you know, Saint Nicholas or Santa Claus, and aspects of indigenous knowledge. And so the kind of it kind of came together in this strange amalgamation.
Well, it sounds like a very strange yet beautiful way of sort of weaving various tales across the globe together. But, you know, why center an indigenous perspective? You know, why is that really important for you to do?
So, you know, and disclaimer, I'm not indigenous. I don't claim to speak for the indigenous culture. But as a sociologist, I teach climate change at UConn. I've been teaching it for over 10 years, society and climate change. And every year I realize that the essential tools of addressing the causes, right? Because we often think climate change is the problem, but climate change is a symptom of a social organization, a culture that is the problem. And we also like to say all humans are destroying the planet. All humans are causing climate change, anthropogenic climate change, which means, you know, human created. I'm like, no, actually, this is a cultural construction. There are lots of humans, in particular indigenous humans, who are not causing it and whose cultures are ancient and whose relationships to their land have models that we need to learn from, even as our culture, again, has tried to eliminate them because, in many ways, for their relationship with the land. And this is still going on, right? I mean, if you are an activist in around the world, in South America or in Indonesia, and you're an indigenous activist trying to save the forest that is your life, that is your cultural identity, you may very well be eliminated because we have interests. We have oil. We have gas. We want. And so that to me felt really important to give kids and adults and everybody a perspective that this is a values issue.
And of course, illustrations play a really big part in your book.
Yeah.
And it's so detailed. And we have images of those illustrations on our website at ctpublic.org/where we live. If you'd like to go take a look, definitely highly recommend, because it's just it's so wonderful and so detailed in ways that you really kind of have to look at them to really get the story. But, you know, can you tell us, walk us through, you know, how did those illustrations reinforce this retelling of Santa Claus and centering things ecologically?
Yeah, so I wanted Santa to be dressed in a more traditional way. You know, embroidery and not have, you know, the red outfit that we've come to get, you know, that represents Santa Claus and the little hat. I wanted it to have, again, more of the authentic ideas of who is this person in terms of the human story, right? You know, and you know, there are elves in my story. But again, if you go around the world, people believe in trolls, people believe in fairies. And, you know, when I say believe, it's sort of loose, right? You know, they're part of, if you want to get Jungian, of sort of the collective unconscious of, you know, dragons appear all over the world, shaman appear all over the world, right? And so it's like there's this massive reservoir of ideas of which humans around the world over time have pulled images and stories and threads that I think make cultures richer rather than for a lot of people, if you say, you know, these are stories, none of them are true and none of them are false, right? I think that enriches our lives rather than take something away. Right. You know, your cultural story is as true and as false as mine. And that plurality is what we need also, because, you know, we cannot address climate change until we deal with racism and, you know, homophobia and all of the isms and our religious bigotries and the way that we see ourselves as separate. Right. We have to see ourselves as one species with many, many other species, right? And that's also part of the story. And I love in Coco's Fire, that part, you know, there are other species on this planet who have as much right you know, if we want to use the language of rights to life and liberty on this planet.
Well, and I think when we have these conversations, we do often. It's not really an accident because they're like you're mentioning. It's all interconnected,
yeah.
Right? And so, Lena, because we mentioned Cocos Fire, I do want to ask you too. You know, as an environmental scientist, you know, what are your thoughts about the way Phoebe framed this particular tale?
Yeah, I love that question. I think a lot from like a science and realist perspective, but I think that these elements of culture and storytelling are so interwoven in how we think about our Earth that I think it's so essential to kind of bring in that those elements of magic into the space. I think like in our story too, we have this sort of imaginary flame character who represents the main character's emotions. And that's very, you know, whimsical and not realistic. And I think that those elements of storytelling can really help kids engage with topics of science. And I think it's essentially intertwined in how we talk about science. And so I think, you know, I think other scientists might be like, oh, it's only the facts and we should.
Sure, right.
But I think in this, these sort of spaces of creative storytelling are so essential.
Forgive me, Phoebe, you go ahead.
Yeah, really quickly, Phoebe.
Yeah, if I could just jump in off that. The research shows that when you bombard people with facts, it doesn't actually reach their emotion. It doesn't motivate them in the way that stories do. In fact, my society and climate change class now, I have students write plays and perform them on campus, right? And sort of telling stories and retelling them, and particularly the story that we are the Earth. You know, we are inseparable from the Earth, as opposed to, you know, we dominate the Earth or we own the Earth or we're going to save her. I mean, all of that language is very challenging for me because it has aspects of patriarchy, like sort of the damsel in distress, the planet, you know, has aspects of sort of whiteness of, you know, we're going to, you know, bring our expertise and fix it. When many ways, you know, our science and if it's not framed properly can contribute to the problem. And I was greatly influenced in my book by a book called Native Science by indigenous author Greg Cahate. And, you know, this idea of the metaphoric mind as being scientific, right, of the way indigenous people have understood their relationship to the planet, we'd be like, oh, no, that's just, you know, that's not science. It's like, no, actually it is, right? It's based on experiential traditions and weaving that into behavior and cultural practices.
And so I want to bring in another perspective here. We're going to hear from Paul Douglas, who we'll be hearing from throughout the hour. So Paul is a meteorologist who wrote A Kid's Guide to Saving the Planet. It's not hopeless and we're not helpless. And he wrote for 9 to 13-year-old nice. Readers. Let's take a listen here.
I never set out to talk about climate change, but I started noticing by the late 90s that the weather was increasingly playing out of tune. There's a natural ebb and flow. There's a rhythm to the atmosphere, but it was as if the seasons were on fast forward and somebody turned the volume of extreme weather up to an 11, Spinal Tap reference for Spinal Tap fans. And I started talking about it. So what stimulated the book? It was the birth of my grandson, my first grandson, Jordan, 4 years ago. It kind of got me off the dime because I had been hearing a lot about eco-anxiety, climate anxiety, young people depressed, anxious, despondent, basically saying, hey, you boomers, you had your chance. You didn't move fast enough. And essentially, you've kicked the can down the road and, you know, left us with a hot mess. And so I wanted to try to counter some of the gloom and doom and basically write a book that talks about solutions and how young people can and should be part of the inevitable solutions. We're going to have to deal with this. We already are. And this may not be a big deal for their parents or grandparents, but for a lot of young people, this is at or near the top of their list in terms of things that they worry about. And it's just to reassure young people that, as the title of the book explains the situation isn't hopeless. We aren't helpless. We have tools at our disposal, everything from picking a career where they can help to come up with clean energy solutions faster. We need teachers. We need scientists. We need journalists. We need people who can speak truth to power. And young people are going to have to deal with this. And I wanted to try to leave them with a sense of optimism that we're going to figure this out, because at the end of the day, we're not going to have a choice.
So we got to go to break right after this. But Jeremy, I do want to get your reaction to Paul. You know, what are your thoughts in terms of there's so many layers here, but definitely a huge point in terms of the intergenerational cultural shift, it sounds like here.
Yeah, well, you know, he brings up this term eco-anxiety, and there's a number of terms out there. Some larger umbrella terms like climate distress sometimes reflect the wide array of emotions that young people feel. But this is not a diagnosable condition, of course, but it is a feeling and a sentiment that is pervasive. And just to highlight kind of a landmark research effort, Caroline Hickman in the UK conducted this global survey of 10,000 young people around the world, showing that almost 60% are very to extremely worried about climate change. 84% were at least moderately worried. Almost 50% had reported that feelings of climate change negatively affected their daily function. 40% or so were almost hesitant to have children. And I think this data is stark and it's dramatic, but it shows that this is a pervasive feeling amongst young people currently, and something that needs to be addressed.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. You've been listening to Jeremy Wartzel, Lena Champlin, and Dr. Phoebe Godfrey, who will be staying with us, and we'll continue this conversation after a quick break. And listeners, you can also join the conversation, 888-720-9677. That's 888-720-WNPR, or leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford Healthcare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford Healthcare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygening it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. How do you tackle the tricky topic of climate change with children? Well, this hour, we're hearing from the authors of three children's books about climate change who believe honesty is the best policy. And back with me is UConn sociologist Dr. Phoebe Godfrey, who's the author of A North Pole Tale. We also have environmental scientists Lena Champlin and Jeremy Wartzel, who are co-authors of Coco's Fire, Changing Climate Anxiety into Climate Action. So I want to ask all three of you about the power of children's literature and art in tackling big topics like what we're talking about today, climate change. But first, Jeremy, we were just talking about the generational sort of cultural shift in how we talk about climate change. And it sounds like both you and Lena, Paul Douglas and Phoebe here have all thought about how to, you know, strike that balance with tone. So what do we know about common tropes that don't have that same inspirational effect on young people? Jeremy, I'll start with you.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine. I think it's such an important question, because historically, the tropes that are used to convey kind of this generational shift are pretty daunting. You know, a book that I think is inspiring to so many, The Lorax by Dr. Seuss, ends on a pretty dark note, where you have the one slur throwing the seed the truffle trees to the next generation, really kind of saying, my generation messed up, good luck fixing that. And I think to some that's inspiring, and to others, That's a really big ask, right? And I think that that is an inherently daunting and an alienating strategy, one that I think is really pervasive in this conversation. And so one thing that Lena and I really made an effort to transition in our book was to switch and flip that narrative on its head, saying, welcome to the, you know, please, younger generation, welcome to this thriving community of activists and politicians and scientists all thinking about these issues. Come join us. And I think that was in our research, something that was really lacking, this empowering message.
And Phoebe, because you talked about the risk of actually this approach, really what Jeremy was describing here, you know, what do you think about that fine line between, you know, welcome, let's find a solution versus, oh, here's the problem, good luck.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to link it to the Lorax in terms of the single boy, you know, and the story. And, you know, and I actually use the Lorax because, you know, we're never very clear that the Onceler represents capitalism. I mean, he is the ultimate capitalist, right? Making a sneed that everybody needs and sort of using all of the truffular trees. And part of what I look for in the book, and I love in their book that there's also, you know, activism, is this collective movement, right? And I have two levels of it. One is the children's letters, right? Children write to Santa pretty regularly. You know, it's quite amazing how many numbers of letters get sent. And in those letters, in the story, Santa discovers that I'm a teacher, I'm like, students. The children are asking for things that are not things. And that's part of the solution, is that what do we value, right? You know, most children want their parents' time. They want love. You know, they want parks. They want spaces. They want to save the penguins. They want, you know, and it's like, oh, I don't have any time. I can't give you that. But, you know, here's an Xbox. Right. And how our culture has used commodities to basically pacify all of us. Right. Well, you're not going to have, you know, to be an artist, but here, have a rubber duck instead. You know, I'm seeing Colin's rubber duck, you know, but the use of commodities. Right. Part of it, Marx referred to it as commodity fetishism, right? That we're kind of obsessed with the stuff. And then the other level in the book is we have the three R's, but then through a colleague of mine, he invited me to add another R, which is rights. And so at the end of the book, the elves protest and they ask Santa for snow days off and they ask for a vacation after Christmas. And so thinking about workers' rights, right, and how much of that is also a part of organizing and bringing kind of change to our culture, right? And that could be the rights of students, right, to be, you know, treated with respect or have safe schools or, you know, learn about climate change, or the rights of, like I said, workers or indigenous rights or rights of oppressed minorities. And you know, so the activism is in the story in multiple ways.
Well, I think rights is the fourth R.
Yes.
So what are the first three?
The most popular is recycle, right? We all kind of learned that, like you said. You think you learned that before you learned about climate change. Mm-hmm. Reuse, right? And that's problematic because things are designed with designed obsolescence. Things are designed to break, and we're kind of forced to throw them away. And then the one that has dust all over it is reduce. Mm-hmm. Right? Again, our capitalism is not interested at all in reduction. And so, you know, if we took that seriously, the reduction that we're told is like, oh, turn the lights off. And it's like, no, that's not the level that we're talking mm-hmm. about. The reduction of production. And in the story, you know, Santa's kind of confronted with that the toys come from somewhere, right? They come, you know, to make all these toys requires cutting down forests, is linked to species extinction, is linked to water pollution, is linked to all of the other parts of climate change that, again, don't necessarily get as much traction, you know, the loss of habitat. And so, yeah, and adding rights, I think, is really important, right? And you could also talk about the rights of nature, right? That, you know, rivers and animals and forests, do they have rights in the same idea of a right to exist as they are, not for our use. And again, our use under the economy that we have.
And I want to bring in Paul Douglas again here. He's a meteorologist who's also the author of A Kid's Guide to Saving the Planet. It's not hopeless and we're not helpless. Let's take a quick listen here.
I didn't want to sugarcoat the science. And the first half of the book roughly is explaining the science. And I'm always, again, amazed by fifth, sixth, seventh graders who are really up on what's happening and understand what's happening. And they get it. Actions have consequences. You can't release all these chemicals into the atmosphere and expect nothing to happen. But I wanted to devote the second half of the book to very concrete, specific solutions, how young people can get involved, how they can start climate clubs in their schools, how their career choices might actually be part of the solution. And again, things around the house, things that all of us can do to shrink our carbon footprint, just common sense stuff that in the end will save people money. And I know we're all juggling a zillion challenges day in and day out. Parenting is difficult. And I guess if your fifth grader comes to you and says, hey, mom, dad, what are you doing? How are you trying to make a difference? I don't know if that has an effect or not. I hope it does.
And Lena, we'd love to get your thoughts in response to Paul here, and especially as an environmental scientist, you know, hearing this from a meteorologist, and we were also talking about climate action earlier. You know, what does that look like, Lena?
Yeah. I think I really liked how he described that he broke down, like, his book into describing the science and then actions to take against it. It feels like a very scientific approach to, you know, present the science and the information and then ways that we can engage with it. I think that it is really an interesting challenge in science I think a lot of science communication has been framed around telling the science. And I think that we've realized that doesn't make an impact. It's not that there's a deficit of knowledge of the science. I think we have, like, you know, I like that he said, kids have a lot of knowledge, and oftentimes it's kids bringing these topics to their caregivers to be like, I care about climate change and I know about climate change. And so it's not that we need to just teach people more science. I think that we need to frame the conversation more around how to engage with what people need. And I think another challenge in science is really thinking about the local and the global. And I think that we oftentimes can engage more with the impacts that we're seeing locally and the ways in which, you know, our communities are being impacted by this global problem, but it's easier to engage on a local scale. And I think that's a way that we can kind of address this is thinking about what people need in our communities locally.
Well, and Phoebe, I want to throw this question to you too, you know, response to what Paul had to say, and also, you know, what does taking action look like to you, especially with your framework in A North Pole Tale?
Yeah, so for me as a sociologist, part of what I see as taking action is addressing the cultural values. So, for example, yesterday in class, I'm teaching sustainable societies. We were looking at reproductive justice, right? And how much patriarchy and the oppression of women actually contributes, whether through our narratives around population. Oh, you know, population is the problem. And it's like, well, is that accurate in terms of how women in the global south or women who have less resources are entrapped in relationships that might not give them the power over their own reproduction. Also, when we're thinking about consumption, it's easier to blame, it's people in the global south who are having too many children versus people in the global north who are using too many resources. And there's a direct correlation with income and education and population decline. And so, you know, inviting students, you know, you want to work on climate change, become an anti-racist. Right? Because part of racism is also embedded in our relationship to the planet. If we think back to white supremacy and how it framed the other, it was, oh, they're closer to nature. Oh, they're, you know, the indigenous were savage because they were closer to nature. And so there's this despise of nature, right? Nature represents that which is in need of civilizing, controlling, containing. And so when we take these larger cultural narratives, it helps students realize, oh, I can be a climate activist if I start shifting my own values and my own perceptions of who we are, who other people are, and how I present myself in the world.
And, you know, just from this conversation, we have so many things going on. And I mean, there's a very large list of things to pay attention to, and not just for adults, but for young people. And it's a very heavy list. And Jeremy, I would love to get your thoughts first. You know, we bringing it back a little bit on the power of literature and art in tackling difficult topics for younger people. And my producer, Katie, and I were thinking about a quote from Madeline Nenangle, who said, if the book will be too difficult for grown-ups, then you write it for children. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Jeremy, on that?
Yeah, it's such an important question, Phoebe. So many important points you just mentioned. I really appreciate your comments. Catherine, to your question, you know, I think, as a psychiatrist and as a clinician, I often have to communicate very complex, very challenging topics to adults and to kids. And I find that my strategy is just the same, which is to distill it down into very digestible, approachable points, right? And I think that when anyone has to tackle something huge, approaching it like you would a child, obviously in a developmentally appropriate way, can be enormously helpful. One thing that I think comes to mind is, you know, as a psychiatrist, you think a lot about emotions. And I think a Pixar movie that did such an incredible job was Inside Out. You know, we are inherently concrete thinkers, and to give people images of their emotions, characters that they can relate to, was enormously helpful in providing young people a language. And so in Coco's Fire, we used our little fire creature as this manifestation of anxiety that you could talk with, that could be interactive, and that could be engaging. And I think that can be really helpful to help people put their finger on the pulse of what might be troubling them, because emotions and anxiety is such an ethereal and intangible aspect. And so that is certainly how we approached it. I did just want to comment on something Phoebe mentioned, which was like, how do we actually tackle, what are the approaches that we take in terms of addressing this climate anxiety, this climate distress? And the research actually shows that there's a couple of big buckets that we can use, whether it's activism and engaging in pro-environmental behaviors, getting more education that's psychodynamically oriented and provides a space for anxiety and us to express our emotions, and finally to connect with nature, have all been avenues that people have studied. How do we address this climate anxiety? How do we address this climate distress? These are three avenues by which people have shown that can be effective.
What's funny, when you mentioned Pixar, the first movie that came into my mind was Inside Out, just based on the context. So love that you mentioned that, and that's sort of characters that helps us understand our emotions. And we got about a minute left here, but I do want to get Lena and Phoebe's thoughts on this too. You know, what are your perspectives on the power of literature in tackling these harder topics for younger audiences? Lena, we'll start with you.
Sure. I think one thing that we've been sort of dancing around is that, like, children's literature in its name sounds like it's for kids, but I think it really is. I think it's inspiring to me because it's impactful to so many groups. So, like, it's impactful to caregivers who are reading those books, to people that can use them, like us in our outreach. And I think it's just so amazing that each of us here are coming from different disciplines and using this creative tool to connect. I think art is the thing that can connect people to science.
I love that point because all of your backgrounds are actually very different, but very connected, as is on theme with this conversation. But Phoebe, we know your book is really intended for all ages. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's really a folktale. Like I think of the Grimm's Tale or all of the way, you know, I mean, the New Testament is full of stories, right? You know, metaphors and going back to Greg Cahati's metaphoric mind, you know, and one thought when you said about if it's too difficult for adults to turn it into a children's book is the emperor has no clothes, right? It's the child who knows, right? Children know things are not right in our culture. There's some, right? And adults, we get socialized into denial and all the ways that we deny things in our culture, you know, and somehow make them seem like it's okay. It's normal to treat people like that, or it's normal to treat the earth like, and children are like, really, really? And then, you know, So I think, you know, children have this incredible intelligence that it is grounded in their relationship with their bodies, with the planet, with animals, and we need to build on that on every level.
Well, they will tell it like it is.
Yeah, that's for exactly. Sure. Exactly.
You've been listening to Dr. Phoebe Godfrey, Lena Champlin, and Jeremy Wurzel, who will be staying with us because we'll be continuing this conversation after a quick break. And listeners, you can also join the chat if you want, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. This hour, we're hearing from the authors of three children's books about climate change and taking action. And back with us is UConn sociologist Dr. Phoebe Godfrey, who's the author of A North Pole Tale, and also environmental scientist Lena Champlin, who's a psychiatry resident, and also Jeremy Wurzel, who is a co-author with Lena of Coco's Fire, Changing Climate Anxiety into Climate Action. So we've been talking a lot about climate change and action to the climate change, but I also want to hear from all of you about reactions to your respective books and what's that been like. Lena, let's start with you.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's been really, really inspiring for me to have the book be a way that I've connected to people. So it's been really fun to do like local readings at the museum where I used to work or libraries and schools. And I think it's a very didactic book. So I think it pairs well with like surrounding discussion and lesson planning. I think that it's been really cool just to like, you know, see photos of people reading the book. I think that I would promote anyone engaging in a similar sort of creative project to talk about their work, because I think that in my own feelings of climate stress and everything, it feels like this is something that I have actively done. And I think that's really, there's a really beautiful sort of meta level there.
Right, absolutely. And I actually kind of felt like Coco's Fire is a little bit of a warm hug, a little bit of a nice little embrace after getting very anxious about climate change. Jeremy, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think the reception has been really great. And I think a large part of that has to do with the team that worked on this book. The way we went about it was we partnered with the Group for the Advancement of Psychiatry, which is a research think tank for the American Psychiatric Association. So it was a team of psychiatrists, psychologists, young people, environmental scientists, all really put a lot of thought about it over a year trying to figure out the best strategy that's developmentally and psychoeducationally appropriate. And so through that network, we've been able to reach doctor's offices and schools, and so we've been able to try and develop this larger mental health community. And so we can't thank the Group for the Advancement of Psychiatry's Climate Committee enough for their help. Actually, all of the proceeds from this book go directly to funding more research to understand how the climate impacts our mental health. And so it's been a wonderful process and a wonderful journey.
And Phoebe, how has reactions been like for your book?
Yeah, when I first self-published it, I did kind of like they were saying, I did some readings. You know, I write for a little local paper called Neighbors in the northeast corner. I've, you know, got some friends to read it. I got an Eastern children's professor to read it and write a review. But it's very hard as a self-publisher, and, right. and again, I'm sure they know, you know, to get the kind of traction, you know, I also have a full-time job and I've got this, and, you know, so I just kind of, I've just allowed it to sit for a while. And I've always said, it's a little before its time. We're not ready. We're not ready to take on, you know, this issue, and certainly not with the intersection of Christmas. You know, we're not ready to question, you know, should we further commercialize this holiday that is supposed to be about spirituality, right? And I'm not a Christian and I'm not religious, but I grew up with Christmas, you know, in kind of a pagan family way. But, you know, we always had gifts, but not too much. And kind of telling kids, you know, maybe the gift you really want is to not be bullied. Mm. Maybe the gift you really want, you know, like I said before, is more time with your parents. And, you know, again, it's challenging some of our sacred American values, which is buy, buy, buy. I mean, as I was driving here, you know, on NPR, like, American consumers have bought more this year so far than ever. And it's like, what do we not understand about the, you know, that all that stuff comes from somewhere? You know, it doesn't miraculously just come out of the air, you know, and it comes out of trees and soil and mining and oil and you know, and it's like, and so I'm patient. I have a lot of belief that our culture has to change. Kind of like Paul was saying, we have to change.
Well, and speaking of Paul, we're going to hear from Paul one last time. And I do want to get some really quick final thoughts from each of you. But I want to hear from meteorologist Paul Douglas, who again wrote the book, A Kid's Guide to Saving the Planet. It's not hopeless and we're not helpless.
The one constant in this age where we don't seem to agree on anything, we love our kids. We love our grandkids. Most of us would do anything to help our kids and our grandkids. And that unites us. And if you truly love your kids and your grandkids, you'll pay attention to this subject, not dismiss it as political. It's data. It's science. The biggest skeptics on the planet are scientists. Science is organized skepticism. And the fact that you have thousands of PhD climate scientists who all agree, 99.8%, that, hey, something's going on. It's us. It's not volcanoes. It's not the sun. It's us. And we need to figure out solutions, because at some point, if it hasn't happened yet, your child or your grandchild will come up and ask you about this. When did you know about climate change? What did you do about it? Did you sit on your hands? Did you ignore the scientists, chalk it up to politics? Or did you make an attempt to do the right thing and at least acknowledge that something is going on? Connect the dots. I've got two grandsons now, and I want to be able to answer that question when they come to me and say, hey, Papa, what did you do? When did you know about this? And at least say, you know, I did everything I could in my power to get the word out and get people thinking about this and maybe thinking a little bit differently.
All right, you all each get 30 seconds for this quick final thought. Lena, your response to Paul.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for this conversation, because I think it's so meaningful to me to like talk about this topic from so many different angles. And I think it is through these conversations and perspectives that we can address climate change. So I just appreciate this time for us to all speak together.
Absolutely. And Jeremy, same question to you.
Yeah, likewise. This has just been such a lovely conversation. And so I'm so glad to have this opportunity. Thanks for having us. Quickly, you know, I speak with a lot of young people, and they're concerned, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that is challenging. And what I, through the research that I've done and through working on this project, I think the overwhelming sense is, yes, this is hard, but wow, how amazing is it that people come together, and how many opportunities are there to help? And so I think that we have to marry this concern and anxiety with optimism and empowerment, because that's been what has been so exciting for me.
30 seconds, Phoebe.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much. And, you know, we love our children, but we also don't love other people's children necessarily. So, you know, kind of curing that and understanding that all children on this planet deserve a livable future, and all beings deserve a livable future. And so, I see it as it's heart work. It's not just intellectual. It's not just the science. It's do we have the emotional will, right, to look at ourselves in the mirror, and particularly our culture, and rethink what are we doing, and what kind of world do we want for all living beings? So thank you so much.
Well, you're all leaving us with a lot of things to think about today. Dr. Phoebe Godfrey, thank you so much for your time. Mm-hmm. Lena Chaplin and Jeremy Wartzel, thank you both also for being on Where We Live today. And also a quick final thanks to meteorologist Paul Douglas as well. You can find links to all three books on our website at ctpublic.org/where we live. I'm Catherine Shen. Today's show is produced by Katie Pellico. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor. Download Where We Live anytime on your favorite podcast app. And thank you so much for listening.